I must learn for myself, not from what someone else has said or done. And so I live my life from day to day and try to smile while feeling my way.
Good morning. This is Jan Weinberg standing in for Carol Cox, a very difficult job indeed. And Nina Simone playing For Myself. As it is said, if you are not first for yourself, then who will be? So think about that and have a beautiful day with us. I'm here in the studio with John Carroll and Makani Christensen. John has been a guest of Carroll's before. In brief, he's a former state legislator, airline pilot, colonel in the U.S. Air Force, and a man of many talents. Makani Christensen, a very handsome indeed young Naval Academy graduate who's involved in community environmental fishing hunting affairs. And I'd just like to welcome everyone. Let's have an enjoyable, entertaining, and educational experience today. And hard, as I said, to stand in difficult for Carol Cox, but we're going to do our best. I'm Jan Weinberg. I'm a personal injury attorney. I've known John for many, many years and just met Makani this morning. So without further ado, gentlemen, could you introduce yourself and kind of give a little background?
Okay, well, I'll go first since I'm the elder here. John Carroll, aloha kakahiaka oval kalelehu okalani. For those of you, that's my Hawaiian name. I just saw my good friend Poka Lainui going out the door. So if he's on listening to us now, I just want to say thank you for doing all that you do. My background is varied. I had my father had been in Japan, and I had been in a ski resort for about 3.5 months, and he said, you either get a job or go back to the mainland and go to college. So I went and got a job in the Merchant Marine, ended up in Hawaii. I won't tell you what year, but anyway, got off the boat, went up to university, met Tommy Kaolakukui, got a football scholarship, came back, and never been able to save up enough money to leave, so I've been here ever since. So in any event, I graduated from college here, got my degree in education, and which is a very principal thorn in the side of this state is how lousy our education system is. Later on, I was a jet fighter pilot for the Air Force and a Hawaiian airline pilot, and finally went to law school, came back, was elected 4 times to the House of Representatives, once to the state Senate, and then have basically been practicing alongside a job at Hawaiian as a pilot at the position in the Air National Guard, both as a fighter pilot and judge advocate. And I've also done international business. I've had a company that I created to supply pilots to Japan Airlines and All Nippon Airways. And other than that, I haven't done anything. So
I think the most important thing is what you mentioned before we began today, and that you do the hula, John. Come on, don't be shy. Now, don't do one now.
That's an interesting. May I just tell it?
Yes, of course.
I always thought, you know, men hula dancers were gay. I just had that feeling. And one day, this partner of mine, Axel Ornelas, his daughter, was getting married, and I don't know if you folks probably aren't old enough to remember him, but Herman Wiedemeyer, who was an All-American, a boxer, a football star, just really tough guy, up at this wedding and dances Hola Va'apa. And I thought, wow, that's pretty neat. So long story short, one of the guys I hunt with's wife is a kumu, and I tell her, can she teach me that hula? So she did, and then I ended up in the Maiki Lake Halau, and I've been dancing there since 1995. And it's terrific exercise, and it's just wonderful activity. I enjoy. I'm always back row Johnny. Nobody wants me out front. But
can I ask a question, John? Are you gay?
I'm sorry.
Are you gay?
Am I gay?
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I'm gay. I'm a lesbian trapped in a man's body.
Now, Makani, how about if we switch subjects and go to your own background?
Well, you know, thanks for having me this morning. Business owner, graduate from the Naval Academy, Command Med Schools, also started the Hunting, Farming, Fishing Association. And, you know, in Hawaii, it's not easy starting a business. But, you know, what's not even harder to do is how do you actually afford a house? Or the cost of living is so extreme, even myself running a business, I can't qualify for a loan to get a house. So it's one of those things, you know, that we definitely got to address and talk about, you know, cost of living, agriculture, how do we be self-sufficient here in Hawaii? Because the people of Hawaii are the ones that will have to basically vote for somebody that has them at the core of their thinking and mentality. And, you know, I think John running in this election against Senator Brian Schatz, you know, has a good shot of actually taking down the incumbent. And I believe that he has the best interest for the people, regardless of party lines. You know, I'm a Democrat, he's a Republican, but I believe that he has what it takes, and he will address these issues, and we have a lot to talk about this morning. So,
well, we're going to segue into some discussion of the local economy in a second, but before we do, if I could divert for a second. Makani, have you run for office before you ran in opposition in the primary to Senator Schatz?
Yeah, I ran for city council about in 2009, I believe it was, when you had Stanley Chang and all those rest of the guys running. Just wanted to see what the process was like. Just threw my name in there, and it was pretty interesting.
Interesting in what respect? Can you highlight a few things you've learned before we start talking about the economy?
You know, at that election, it was more of, you know, I just got back from war, just got back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it was more, you know, you give your basically your life and your time to your country. You come back and you want to see what the process is like. So I jumped in there, threw my name in there, didn't do any campaigning whatsoever, just to see how easy it was to put your name in and try to run for office.
How easy was it?
You just sign a piece of paper and you're in. You're on the list. So that was pretty interesting. But, you know, this last campaign that I did put some real serious effort into it, you know, 2 months running against Brian Schatz in the primary as a Democrat, and, you know, I shook 10,000 hands, literally, and met people from all over the state, great people that really are looking out for the communities, and it was an eye-opening experience, especially now that, you know, John's running, Brian's, they'll both be on a ticket, and the experience was, you know, without any press, like really, literally. And that's what John's facing right now. There's no press out there for the other guy. So that's something that definitely needs to be looked at, especially if we really want to make change in Hawaii.
We'll come back to that later in the show and some further comments. Why don't we get into the local economy? I know it's an area that John Carroll wanted to address. And, John, why don't you lead off?
Okay, well, first of all, our local economy is being strangled because of the fact that we do not have an open free trade economy here. There's a federal law that was passed in 1920 called the Jones Act, and most people have not even heard of it. And yet it has a huge impact on everything we do every day. That law says that if a ship is not built, manned, owned, flagged, and maintained in America, it cannot travel in interstate commerce. Now, that doesn't mean other ships can't come to Hawaii, but the net effect of it is they cannot come to Hawaii and then go do business in another state. So if a ship from China's got, say, 80% of the load for California and 20% for here, they're not going to come here and drop 20% and not worry about the other 80%. So the net effect is if they bypass Hawaii, go to California or Oregon or Seattle, and then put the goods on a Jones Act ship and bring them back here. The net effect of that is that we have this huge difference. I compared prices in Nevada to here, and just to give you a couple examples, ground beef was $2.87. $2.87 in Vegas and $5.99 in Hawaii. And it goes on and on and on. And we're up to, like, for V8 juice, it's 120% more expensive here than it is in Vegas. Now, the reason for that is that you've got the Jones Act, and then let's say, well, why do we have the Jones Act? It was designed after World War I to ensure that we had a strong, vibrant merchant fleet, which we do not have. The net effect of it has been basically to kill the merchant fleet. The Korean ships, Danish ships, Dutch ships, Norwegian ships are all way better than American merchant ships, and we have a decaying merchant fleet now, and people just will not buy American-built ships because they're too expensive, and in some cases they're not even up to standards as far as national shipbuilding standards are concerned. We had this business of that ship El Toro or something like that that went down offshore of off the East Coast. It turns out that the engine quit, the thrusters that would normally be on the bow had also quit, and they had stern thrusters, which I've never heard about. This is all after they recovered the ship, was discovered. And what apparently happened is they got into these heavy seas, was so bad they could not control it, and these men were beaten to death, and nobody couldn't get outside to even launch a life raft. So it was just pitiful that this kind of thing happened, and it's because of this decaying merchant fleet that we have. Now, Senator Schatz has come out and said he will not even consider repealing, amending, or asking for exemptions to the Jones Act. And he says this is because it's protecting Navy shipbuilding. Now, this is absolutely absurd, and I don't know how somebody in the U.S. Senate can be that far off on the facts and still remain in office.
Can I back up for a minute, John? Sure. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You know, again, even as a lawyer, the history of the Jones Act, until researching it a little bit, I know that it's an act that helps seamen, protects them from injuries and from suffering. It's a very dangerous trade. So you acknowledge there are some good aspects to the Jones Act. Are you trying to get rid of those aspects of the Jones Act that help people?
Yeah. No, absolutely not. The Jones Act provisions that I'm talking about strictly had to do with shipbuilding, ownership, and so forth, and the interstate commerce provision, and which totally violates the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause, as you well know, says that it says that every state is supposed to have equal access to interstate commerce with the states, nations, and Indian tribes. And we don't even have highways, pipelines, or railroads, so we've got nothing even remotely assuring interstate commerce, and now they're cutting off shipping, which was the one viable connection that we had other than air. So
do me a favor, John, and think of a reason why anyone would be opposed to a modification of the Jones Act to exempt, and I know Puerto Rico's trying to get an exemption, or at least another island,
exactly,
and
yeah.
Hawaii. What would be the, do your best, you're a lawyer, come up with a ground or a reason for you to play for the opposition. Why do they want to keep the Jones Act the way it is?
Well, number one is, if you own Matson stock, you won't ask the question. Alexander Baldwin owned Matson. The shipbuilders are paying money. If you go through the contributions to Senator Schatz, he's got like $2 million, and a lot of it is coming from these various organizations that are making money off of the fact that they have the Jones Act restrictions. I've seen... And I got it. Well, I can't tell you how I got it, but I got a copy of a confidential financial statement from Matson. It's about half an inch thick. The first page on the bottom says the major asset, in effect, of the Matson is the retention of the Jones Act, because it protects them from any kind of competition other than Pasha or Horizon, both of whom have very serious problems. And plus, that's another story. But the main thing is that there's major money going to the people that are keeping that thing going. And other than that, the fact that he came out and said it's connected to Navy shipbuilding, I cannot believe that, actually.
Do you know what that means? I don't quite understand.
Well, the thing is designed to protect merchant shipbuilding. It's got nothing to do with the Navy. And the fact of the matter is that he doesn't want an exemption for Hawaii or Puerto Rico, apparently. But the Department of Defense, whom this whole thing was designed to help, does not use any Jones Act ships. They're all foreign bottoms for all of our logistical supply worldwide. And they have this total exemption, no Jones Act ships used by the Department of Defense. And this exemption was put in there to make sure that if we had a war, there would be a vibrant merchant ship to support logistical.
So to break that down again, you're saying the purpose for which the Jones Act was created in the first place, a central purpose, most of our naval ships are being built abroad in any event.
Well, no, I think, no, I don't know.
I didn't
about
understand.
That. I think
you
most
that.
Of our naval ships are built in the United States. Well, McConaughey can answer that, but no, I think we build the best naval ships in the world, and they're all over the place. But I don't know of any place that builds ships better than we do on Navy ships.
They're gray.
ask him that question.
Yeah. Sure. Tell us about your experience on those.
My experience, I was in the Marines, Naval Academy. I got to do a couple summer cruises on a couple gray hulls. Went on to the USS Greenville, which was a fast attack submarine out here in Hawaii. And it was interesting because, you're on a submarine. You can't see anything. You're traveling around the islands. It's 4th of July. You look up and the chief tells you, hey, come check this out. It's fireworks going off in Lahaina. Oh, wouldn't you like to be there? Yeah, chief. That's nice. So that was my pretty much inaugural trip. And I said, you know what? I'm done with this.
No submarines.
No submarines, no ships. So, but yeah, our ships are basically, all of our ships were built here in America. There's a lot of secret stuff on these ships, and we just want to make sure that security is definitely there. But, going back to the Jones Act, how does this affect, the people on the piers, the dock workers, the labor unions? Because it seems that Those are the strong forces behind everything, but the benefit for doing some adjustments to the Jones Act would benefit all the people of Hawaii.
Exactly.
Especially the dock workers.
Yeah.
Because they'd still be making the same amount of money.
So you don't see this hurting any of the unions or the people who work on longshoremen or the seamen who are on board these vessels?
Yeah. Well, the Jones Act, I mean, that's the Merchant Marine Act, I believe, and it was designed to ensure that they didn't have oppressive working conditions for seamen, and I believe the dock workers, the longshoremen were brought into that.
Right.
But to address this point, Isaac Fiesta was the head of the ILWU for the Big Island, and I was running for, I guess, state senate. And I told him, Isaac, if we go down to the docks today, and I was given this chance to meet with the leaders of the ILWU, what do you think we're going to see? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, what's going to be down there? He said, well, there might be a passenger ship. There might be some barges. I said, what about merchant ships? And I said, what is ILWU? Isn't that International Longshoremen Union? He says, yeah. I said, what do longshoremen do? Don't they unload ships? He says, yeah. I said, well, how come you are against something that would allow merchant ships to be coming in here like crazy from around the world? And we will go back inside. I never heard from him again. So, but their attitude is they've got a monopoly on the docks. They've got a monopoly working the crane operators, and I got nothing against them. I'm happy for them to make their money, but they make like 150 grand a year, those guys. But, what happened to the guys that are pulling those stuff out of the holds, and it's just not happening. So anyway, that's the longshoremen definitely would benefit. Our businesses would benefit. Our agriculture is in the pits right now because we don't have the ability to farm profitably. We used to have Am I talking too much?
No, it's just, let's say that we're just for now finished with the Jones Act.
No.
But I don't mean finished talking about the effects of the Jones Act, but which I'd like to go into. So in your world, your vision, if the Jones Act were changed so that now, you know, foreign ships could stop in Hawaii, paint the with their load of cargo and food and whatever is being brought to the islands, how do you envision the situation being then? What would the Hawaii world look like?
Well, number one, it would make a fantastic increase. And if you want an example, you look at Singapore. They have 250 square miles of land, and they have a gross domestic product in excess of $300 billion per year. They have 60, 70 ships lined up in the channel outside the islands, bringing goods in, taking goods out. Hawaii has 6,000 square miles of land, and I'm just talking about the major islands now. And if we had shipping coming in and shipping going out, and by the way, foreign ships can come here with no problem. The question is they can't go to another state and do business. But the net effect of opening it up would mean that Korean and Japanese and Russian and Chinese and so forth, all those goods could be coming in directly from those countries, offloaded here, and we could be producing mango and, you know, dry land taro and pineapple and all of the terrific stuff that we produce here and shipping it worldwide, and including our livestock. We've got no hoof and mouth. Don't get me started. But anyway, the tremendous impact of having this open market here, or free trade, it just boggles my mind, and I've seen it decay from when I first came to Hawaii. You had ships down there. We were shipping sugar worldwide, and pineapple was all over the place. And in fact, I drove truck for Standard Oil, and I used to deliver barrels of oil to the Dole cannery, which now doesn't exist. So anyway, I can just see a tremendous burgeoning of this society, of this economy, if we got rid of that. And it would happen in about 2 to 3 years, I believe.
First question I would have is, do we even have the infrastructure in the harbors to support this change that you're envisioning?
Number one, Honolulu Harbor is not too much you can do it, but Kalaeloa can be expanded, and it would be. It might have to be deepened. I understand there's some Chinese ships right now that are so big they could not even get into our docks as they exist, but this is something for the state to plan and figure out how to
well,
make
stepping
it work.
Back, if we're talking about infrastructure, what I'm trying to get at, in a sense, is that perhaps this money, instead of being spent on a rail to nowhere, might have been spent, on building up the infrastructure of our harbors to actually be an international focal point.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Has anybody ever assessed the cost to try to accomplish that mission of improving and upgrading harbors, or just never gone there because it's futile right now?
Well, they don't want to talk about it because Matson basically controls those docks right now, and anything that would happen to improve it is going to impair their total control, is what I see.
So,
but I mean, that's just a guess, but that's...
Let's talk about the economy you envision that makes agriculture more of a priority for the islands. Can you paint a picture, John, of how you see the state advancing itself agriculturally so that perhaps we could be self-sufficient?
Yeah. Well, absolutely, but I will do that. But what I wanted to bring up, and if Poca's listening, I want him to notice, as far as I can see, there are 24,000 and up to 44,000, depending on what number. But the bottom number is 24,000 people who are 50% Hawaiian who are on the list for Hawaiian homelands leases, and they cannot get them. And they have, the Hawaiian Homes Commission is leasing land to Parker Ranch and other places like this, and that all of these people are not able to get land that they're basically entitled to under the 1920 Hawaiian Homes Act. Okay, that's number one. And a lot of the farming right now that's done and has been done is done by leaseholders of Hawaiian ancestry, like Larry Mihau is a good example. The Dowsett family is another one up in Waimea. But anyway, if that, number one, if that land was released and they could get it for agricultural use, that's one basic group of people who probably very much would be involved almost immediately in the agricultural business. In addition to that, we've got thousands of acres of totally fertile, beautiful, agriculturally potentially productive land. Like if you drive between Schofield Barracks and Mokulei'a, and I fly, you know, over there, and it's just nothing. And there used to be pineapple, there used to be sugar and so forth. Those two things, plus Lanimu is around the corner. All of that's gone. Now, if we have farmers, and I know we do, that are entrepreneurially, like McConaughey here, oriented, they can see what's going to sell and what to grow to make the money. And the fact of the matter is, and this is a little bit aside from pure ag, but we have no hoof and mouth, we have no mad cow disease here. We have probably the most pristine livestock in the entire world. So our meats and that can be sold as they sell Kobe beef worldwide, that we could have the same thing with Hawaiian beef. The other thing is, as an aside, I had my dad was given a sword, one of the katana, and they have a end that's in the scabbard, but you can, if they pull that off, they can look at the inscriptions, and it can say, you know, who made it and what year and so forth. So this happened to be a Tokugawa era sword, and so I was very, you know, happy to find it. So I asked this vice president of Japan Airlines, what can I give this guy to, you know, as a gift? Because he hadn't charged me anything. So he says, we'll give him a cantaloupe. I said, a cantaloupe? Are you kidding me? This is Sapporo now in January. And he said, no, I'm not kidding. He'll love it. So I go to the store to buy a cantaloupe, $45 for a cantaloupe. Now, if they pay $45 for a cantaloupe, they pay $145 for a mango. So what I'm looking at is the stuff that we produce here, like dryland taro. Do you know we bring taro in from China because we produce so little of it here, and yet we can produce, you know, dryland taro by accident. And on my farm, that happens. But so there's just tremendous opportunity for agriculture, plus for business. We can have non-polluting businesses, you know, statewide, if you will. And because we can get goods in here, we can produce them and send them out. We can also be a financial center of the world because of our time position. You know, you've got New York and London, and you've got China and Japan over here, and we're right dead center, multilingual capabilities. That is something that nobody's really looked into, but it's one of the things I think could happen here. I mean, I may be dreaming, but that's but the agricultural thing I have absolutely no doubt about, and the potential for doing things business-wise, as is done in Hong Kong and Singapore, is clearly here. We need the leadership. That's why McConaughey is here today, because he's going to be part of that leadership very soon.
Well, we'll come back to McConaughey in a minute. You know, John, you've given us an encyclopedia of things to think about. And I just wanted to come back to let's focus on food and agriculture, if we might. I've always wondered, first, are the soils that you've talked about in the former pineapple and sugarcane fields appropriate for use now, or would that have to be taken into account to get crops planted that would,
flourish,
be
yeah.
productive? Yeah.
They do, because of the amount of pesticides and herbicides that have been used in the past, there is a problem with that, but it's a solvable problem. And it's certainly worth the effort if we have to do it for those particular areas. But I haven't heard about it with pineapple. I have heard about it with sugar.
A lot of the land that we're looking at, you know, up there in Kunia, you know, it's, a lot of it's acidic, really acidic. So they have to, you know, obviously treat the soil with the basic component to get it back to normal levels. So, you know, as a small farmer, if you're out there, and you decide to take a lease on from the Hawaii, and let's say you have $5,000 or less to basically clear 1 acre, 2 acres, and you got to come up with the mortgage payment for your house, and you're going to do this full time. It's going to be really, really difficult because, you know, you don't get paid until your crop grows. So for 6 months, you know, you're sitting there, you're working the land, but you're surviving off of $5,000.
Right.
And, you know, for a lot of, I think that right now there's 31 applicants that have applied for lands from the state for the leases. Of those 31 applicants, you know, who really qualifies for this, for that land? It's a, in Hawaii, we don't have people that want to farm and put in that risk. Especially with all the things that have come up, with, protesting GMOs, protesting pesticides, protesting everything. It's like, why would you want to go fishing? If it's so a hostile environment, it's like we're just scaring off our people that actually want to farm and provide food. Because right now, remember, 80% of our crops come in from outside, from the shipping. And you look at this, the Jones Act, you know, 82% more expensive here than Las Vegas on average.
Yeah.
And there is a demand for food and produce here in Hawaii. But we don't have farmers. The only people that would probably be able to do it are the big farmers.
Makani, do you know how much these leases go for? In other words, if you wanted to get 10 acres in an area like Waimanalo or you know, other areas where it's suitable, how much do those leases go for, if you know?
Are you talking about homelands or just in general from the state?
From the state.
Yeah.
In general. Yeah, you know what? I'm not sure. I'm sure they vary. Hopefully it's cheap. But no matter what, for 6 months, if you got to pay a lease.
Sure. It's a very risky and very expensive. Do you know any, do you have any friends or do you know people who are actually doing the leases and growing food?
You know, I know a few people that are doing it. Dean Okimoto, but I'm not sure what the finances are, but I know, you know, they produce a lot of the locally grown supply for a lot of these restaurants that we have.
John, in your world where you've identified this as like something the Hawaiians would do if they were ever given some homelands to some property, do you think that the land is just so expensive and everything so expensive here that it's feasible, you know, economically to encourage agriculture when development is so lucrative?
Yeah. Well, number one is that I think we need land use control has got to be a major issue in leadership. In other words, what's going to be allowed to be changed from prime ag to commercial or whatever. So that's one thing. But you asked him about – I've had several clients who – have state leases and have had gone through renegotiations with the state and then plus where there's been sales. But there's plenty of people who want to farm. My own son, I have a small farm in the Big Island, and he saved up about $15,000 to set up the hydroponic. Of course, he's got the land available to him, so that's a little different subject. But the fact is, I think a lot of people want to farm, including me, by the way, and although I have not been successful. I know I get bored with it, frankly, but it's but it's there to do, and I think some serious money can be made by the people who know what they're doing, whether it's cattle or vegetables. And plus, there's a big market locally for just freshly grown. You know, who's the I forget the Japanese guy's Richard somebody that's
Richard Ha.
Yeah, who?
Richard Ha.
Yeah, Richard Ha.
Marijuana.
He's okay.
He started. He got one of the permits for.
He did.
Yeah.
Okay, but he was successful in other. Products. Before.
Banana.
Yeah.
So we have a UH School of Agriculture.
Right.
What role does it play, if any, in fostering an environment where crops, land will be used for food?
Well, I think it plays a big role, and in fact, tropical agriculture should be. We should be the leading. You know, the leader in that whole industry worldwide. Because we've got a tropical place, we've got the land, we've got everything to basically know what can go wrong or what can go right and how to make it happen. So I think we're ideally suited for that. And I think if we had the kind of, I personally very, very skittish about the GMO, because my dad was a chemical engineer and one of his jobs was creating an agricultural chemical industry for Korea, Nation of Korea, and he, over a couple of years, they had put out this huge bumper crop of wheat, due largely to what he had put into their growing techniques. And anyway, the thing becomes attacked, but with a wheat rust, and the only thing that would kill the wheat rust was this fluid, this liquid thing, and he figured some way to gasify it, and it saved thousands of tons of wheat, and it was a worldwide, I'll show you if you guys want to see the newspaper story about it, but so I think he'd turn in his grave if he knew they were putting pesticides into the chromosomes to have a poison inside of a plant. Now that's just my own, you know, I got C minus in chemistry, so what do I know?
I got an A.
But on the other hand, the amount of production they can do is incredible, and so forth. So, but I think absolutely we can be leading in agriculture worldwide, because I've eaten stuff, you know, as an airline pilot, I was in Singapore and, you know, Australia and all around the place, and I've eaten papaya and mango and everything, and nothing is as sweet as a Hawaiian pineapple, and there's nothing as sweet as our mango. And, you know, their mangoes taste like our papaya, and their papaya tastes like sand. So it's just...
And our governor just came up with 2030 to double food production in Hawaii.
Yeah, and he...
And food production, we should take everything into account, you know, the hunting, the farming, the fishing, because all of that produces food for Hawaii. And, you know, we just basically cut off our legs when we expanded the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, and the governor supported it, and then came back and said to everybody, "Oh, we're gonna 2030, we're gonna double food production." Yet you just
And then he cut it off and said, "We got to go to 2030 now because we can't do it." Well, at least he woke
Can
up to
backtrack
the fact
on that. You guys lost me a little bit on this.
So IUCN came to Hawaii.
President Obama came.
President Obama came to Hawaii as well. And the fishermen basically took a huge, huge beating.
Can you explain that, Makani?
Because,
you know, I want to...
So basically what happened, you had the expansion of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, a proposal that came from the Pew Charitable Trust. And who was spearheading this event was basically a bunch of Hawaiians that, Nainoa Thompson in particular, Kamanao Crab, Willie Myla, and a couple other individuals that the Pew had basically hired and to promote the closure of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. And it's basically went from 50 miles, where we got rid of all the small boats. Now we're in from 50 miles to 200 miles.
Makani is a lawyer, and John knows this. We always like to play both sides.
Mm.
So let's step back and explain again what this act did that's very pertinent to the fishing industry in Hawaii. And then I'd like you to almost say what's wrong with that so that we get a clear view of what's not going to work with that in your view. And also then play the devil's advocate and put forth why people would support that.
Yeah.
Other than that, they may have had a financial interest. Are there other good reasons for this? So do your best to do that and enlighten and educate everyone about this. What do they call that act? I can't pronounce it.
The expansion of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands.
Papa.
Yeah,
oh,
no,
Papa.
No, it's Papa Hanamoku Aokea.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll just call it Papa.
Okay. But then it took me about a month to be able to say
I'd have
that,
a hard time saying it.
Yeah,
and it was a direct attack on the fishing industry. You know, what are we going to lose from this? Well, the price of ahi.
Well, first, what does it do exactly?
It just basically, under the Antiquities Act, the president was approached by Senator Schatz, who obviously with the Pew Charitable Trust came up with what they call a legacy project. It's on their website. And this legacy project is to go around the world and pick areas to close off. Because, as you know, the Pew went from a very conservative organization when it was under the actual Pew guys. And then when it came into the public sector, you had in 1998 a total extreme environmentalism is where the direction of the Pew went. This is in an endowment within the last 3 years, they were able to collect almost $6 billion.
So let's get off in a way. You're saying there's a foundation that has its own agenda.
Right.
And they used their money to retain people who, let's give them every benefit of the doubt, believe in this expansion of the territory. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't there be environmental issues that are favorable to it? For instance, the green sea turtles and other species that John Carroll in his career in the state legislature helped foster legislation to protect. Aren't there good environmental reasons for this? And then come back and just give a rounded view of what this act has done and what effect it'll have on Hawaiian fishermen.
Yeah, I can certainly do that. Number one is I'm totally into protecting the environment. Number two is Federal Fish and Wildlife took me out to Pearl and Hermes and Curie back in 72 because of all this environmental law that I had put in place. And then when they came in with this, in Bush, I think about, was it 8 or 9 years ago, they came out with this protection for about 200 miles around the northwest Hawaiian Islands. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a very good thing to have. If they want to expand that, the good that is theoretically going to create is certainly worth the effort. Now, the other part of that is that, yes, that's tremendous, but what does this do to the state of Hawaii? So if you're in Hawaii and you're part of this process, you've got to be looking at what the impact is, and Senator Schatz simply has not done that, and neither has Hirono or Ige. And so you've got a big split going on in the Democrat Party right now because of that fact. And we could maintain that, the Papahanaumokuakea Preserve, if we made the right adjustments to allow Hawaiian fisheries to be utilized there. The other thing that they also need to do, and I've been thinking about this, is they need to basically expand the Coast Guard's ability to patrol that, because that's the only way, because they can keep our fishermen out because the Coast Guard is here. But what about the Russian and Chinese and Japanese ships coming in on the far side? I never saw one Coast Guard ship anywhere near the far end of the island. So
what you're saying is if foreign vessels come in and they want to fish...
Well, we don't know. I mean, I'm presuming they are, because...
And that the Coast Guard doesn't have the enforcement tools, manpower, and ships to prevent
that. Jan, there's something I didn't realize, but they have a worldwide ship tracking procedure now. I forget what they call it, but you can look at say, Singapore and Honolulu and San Diego, and you'll know exactly how many ships are in each harbor. I can't imagine that guys who can afford that kind of equipment wouldn't know where every Coast Guard ship is and be able to, you know, go in and out with impunity, with that kind of technology. So, but overall, I think the idea of preservation and protecting the corals and so forth is absolutely correct way to go. But you've got to look at everything in terms of the reality of life, and part of that is that we have to have fresh fish for Hai's and Michelle's restaurants and, you know, that kind of thing.
So let me ask, what kind of a local fishing industry does Hawaii have?
Well, it's pretty vibrant as far as I know.
Are you talking about the longliners? You have the longlining fleet, 147 permits that operate out of right down here at the Honolulu Harbor. And, you know, they go out daily. They come back in maybe 2-3 weeks or sometimes a month with the catch. Each morning it's unloaded and sold to all the restaurants or the fish buyers that are there, which make its way to the restaurants that help provide jobs for, you know, waiters, chefs, tourism. You know, it's a huge part of our economy. And if we got rid of all of our longliners, not just talking about just the area, but if we got rid of all our longliners, we would not be able to provide enough food. I mean, fish, we'd have to import more. You know, it would have a huge impact on our economy. And, you know, you're looking at our local boats. That's the guys that go around trolling, smaller boats. We catch different fish than the longliners. You know, it's two different kinds of fish. We catch the yellowtail, they catch the big eye, longliners do. So the water, when the water gets rough, there's nobody that wants to be out there, you know. So it's not, fishing isn't easy. And providing at that level how much fish we need to produce for our economy, we wouldn't be able to do it at the small level.
Aren't the local waters kind of fished out?
No, I just went out 2 days ago. Ran into an Ono pile that was huge.
You're talking about like Mempachi and stuff like that? Or are you talking about... he's talking pelagic fish, I think, more.
Yeah, but even even our nearshore waters, I mean, it's pretty vibrant. I mean, you know, when I'm out there, you know, as long as you know how to fish, that's the big thing, right? You know, there's two different eyes that look at the ocean. There's eyes that look at the ocean, see the waves. And there's eyes that look at the ocean and see what's in the water. You know, where would the fish be? You got to be like a fish to understand where the fish are. And, you know, like, we just went out the other day, knew exactly what we wanted, caught exactly what we wanted, and came in within an hour in Mauna Loa Bay. And so that's...
So what consideration was given in passage of this bill to the local fishing industry? They must have representatives or lobbyists. Are you saying that that the act in general is a good act, but that... they should have taken into account Hawaii's local interest in the seas and the fish for our economy and pass this act?
Nah, they shouldn't even pass the act. They need to definitely re-examine this because it was a legacy project. When it goes legacy project, it's not for the benefit of the people. It's the benefit of a couple individuals. The President of the United States, Brian Schatz's legacy, and it's total disregard. And it's just like what we're talking about, the Jones Act, things that would help Hawaii create jobs or make it cheaper for us to live here. Look, we're building homes in Ho'opili right now, and how many of us can actually afford it, you know? We can build as many homes as we want, but if we don't get to the core issues that affect how expensive it is to live in Hawaii... then we'll never solve the problem.
You know, we're gonna keep going on in this vein, and we've touched on different areas: the economy, the Jones Act, not amending the Jones Act to help Hawaii, this PAPA, pardon me if I use an acronym for it, Act, that leaves a legacy that will hurt the local fishing industry. We're going to go on and on because I'd like to ask about the educational system, especially since John was a teacher at one point and Makani has gone through our local educational system. Before we do that, in order for me not to commit suicide right now out of a severe depression, I want to change the topics. What are the good things? Do you guys see some nice developments? I mean, we're hammering the local, political culture in Hawaii and the leadership of our politicians. But before we keep hammering that, if that's going to be the trend, what are the good things? And John, we'll start with you. I mean, you've lived here most of your adult life. Tell us the good things, any trends that you see in Hawaii that look upbeat, and if not, describe what you see has happened over the years to the islands in your view, but not too depressing now. It's Sunday morning,
I understand.
We're hammering some things here.
Well, we're just talking about the fact of life here, but anyway, but before we go to that, I just want to mention one other thing about Papa Hanamoku Okea, is that they have two provisions that these Hawaiians who put this thing together put in. One of them is subsistence fishing, and there was also sustenance fishing. Well, guess what? They can do sustenance fishing. They cannot do subsistence fishing. That means if you catch it, you've got to eat it, but you can't bring anything home. Now, that is the and I learned that from Mililani Trask, and that's the kind of absurdity that we're dealing with that. Okay. The other thing, and I don't know if Makani will like this or not, but there has been a decay in leadership. I mean, when I was in the House and in the Senate, you had people like Tadao Beppu and John Ushijima, Jimmy Wakatsuki, the old Gene King and so forth, and we were able to really get a lot of really good stuff done. And in fact, the green sea turtle and the monk seal, Jack Sewell was the Speaker of the House, and he let me, or I guess he was acting Speaker at that point, and Tada was out. And so they actually let me pass a bill under my own name. And so, in fact, it was so funny. He says, very slowly, very, very slowly, here's resolution so-and-so. They were talking about green sea turtle first and then and a monk seal. So anyway, that has what we had. We had a tremendous economy here prior to that time, prior to 59, and then between subsidies and a lot of other problems that went on, we ended up losing pineapple and sugar, which were our two major components of the economy. At the same time, I've seen a decay in the leadership in the Democrat Party, because we had, remember, Burns and Ariyoshi, and then it started with Waihe'e, and it continued with Lingle and Abercrombie, and this place has just gone downhill since that time. And things that are obvious that could have been done, and that's why I'm backing up McConney, no matter which party he goes to. We need that kind of educative, vibrant leadership again. And one of the things that I intend to do, and I see the potential for it, is as a U.S. senator and an old guy that's not going to be, I probably won't live more than 50 years, I figure, or maybe 45, let's say. But anyway, so I see this decay in the Democrat leadership, but I think it can be rejuvenated, and I think a lot of people in this state don't really think of themselves as one thing or the other, because in this last race, in my primary, I thought if I got 4,500 votes, I would win, and I was right. I ended up getting 27,000 votes. Now, where those votes came from, they got to be from Democrats, because that many people don't even vote in the Republican primary, all told. And I ran against three other people. So I think people are ready for this kind of leadership. The leadership's got to come forward, and they've got to be heard. And that's why I'm demanding that we have debate, at least between Schatz and me, and also on the congressional level. But anyway, I see a tremendous potential here for the future. The leadership can make it happen. Yeah.
McConney?
Everybody's out there listening right now, all 13,000 of you.
more like eight, but go ahead.
Yeah. You know, a lot of you guys just went to church. A lot of you guys are playing golf, driving in your car, just looking up, looking at the sight of Hawaii, you know, just being happy and thankful for the things that we have. And none of this has ever come easy, you know, the freedoms that we have. As you know, John and I served in the military, so we're thankful for our military guys out there, our vets.
Amen.
Those that have put their lives in harm's way to protect these freedoms that we have, to make sure that we have a better place for our kids. And that is something that is positive. When we have hope for the future, hope is something that keeps people together. It keeps us moving forward and keeps our head on straight, you know. I mean, could be the simple fact of looking at your kids and saying, you know what, I got something to do today. I'm going to make it better for you tomorrow, because I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that when you wake up tomorrow, you'll be in bed, but you'll wake up happy. So, you know, we got a lot to look forward to in Hawaii. So, you know, it's just, we live in Hawaii. It's an awesome place to live, and we can always make it better. So that's what's good about where we are right now.
Thanks for that positive statement, McConney. And we all understand that. I think from my point of view, I remember back to when Linda Lingle was elected a candidate, certainly against all odds. And part of the reason was, and this is, I'm not a very political person. I'm not involved in the system like you guys have been. But basically, when she was running, I would go up to people, cab driver, waitress, waiter, anybody, and ask, like, what's happening? Or, you know, who are you going to vote for? And nobody seemed to mind my asking. And almost to a T, every one of them would go and put their hand up to their mouth and go, look, my family's voted Democrat for 35 years, but don't tell anybody I'm voting for Lingle. You know, and that was like the big revolution. In fact, I bumped into her before the election. I didn't know her, and I said, you know, I've got good news for you. You just won the race. And she looked at me like I was a madman. And maybe I was. I had a couple, you know, drinks. And I said, I'm a pollster. I've done my informal polling, and you just won. You know, I think the fact that Linda Lingle won against all odds, and then people didn't see much happen as a result of that, as far as I'm concerned. There wasn't any great shakeup, any great developments. I think that was almost a demoralizing effect on people's belief that by switching to a different horse, that it was going to actually produce some different results. And then from there, I've seen the same old. It's just people are in this state are highly Democratic. It's the way that they're been born and, you know, raised to find that acceptable. And yet we're pointing to almost the underside of this paradise we live in, certainly the most beautiful state in the nation. And I did want to discuss a little bit about, because I see people being beaten down a little bit. It's just like, well, what can you do about this? So maybe Makani can tell us from a younger standpoint, younger persons, how he found himself in the Democratic primary against Senator Schatz. How did things go? What was the reaction you got from local people about how things were going here and what they wanted done? What was any lessons that you've learned from your campaign?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned during the campaign, especially from, you know, just getting to know people, talking to different groups throughout the state, is the biggest concerns they have is cost of living. That's one. Homelessness, the rail. These are big issues that affect everybody here in Hawaii.
You know, buying a home.
Yeah, buying a home. You know, why am I living on a big island paying for the rail? Why am I living on Kauai paying for the rail? That's this all types of questions. And, you know, even when it came to Medicare and Social Security, why is the government spending our money that we put into Social Security all these years? Why is Medicare not working anymore? How did Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, actually affect the elderly? And it did. It definitely affected them, where now you have individuals not receiving service because the doctors aren't getting compensated for Medicare.
You mean they dropped out, the doctors dropped out?
They're like, hey, you know what, the fund that went for Medicare was basically dispersed throughout everything, right? You got to give everybody affordable care. Now, for doctors who get compensated, it's not happening. So there needs to be obviously adjustments to the Affordable Care Act as well. And I know that, you know, you see those kind of things that happen. I know John will get right on top of that. And, you know, our current administration should also look at these things that we're talking about today, because it's important. So,
did you get a sense, Makani, and how did you go about campaigning? Did you do this door-to-door? Did you go to church meetings and community meetings? How does a young candidate like yourself, without the kind of money behind you and press behind you, go about and make your views known to the people?
So we came up with a strategy on how to do it. Number one was to try and secure endorsements. We talked to Tulsi Gabbard's office, talked to all these individuals that, you know, we shared similar, like, objectives, or I could see our views kind of correlate. Well, it turned out that, you know, nobody wanted to endorse. So that was a huge loss, because through endorsements you get media. No media, no endorsements. So, you know, one of the things is you already started this, so you don't stop. So, you know, just hard work, literally.
Let me back up a minute. Let's take the signal. It's break time, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Right.
Carol Cox Show.
From day to day, and try to smile a child.
Carol Cox, who's somewhere in Yellowstone, probably having the time of his life on a well-deserved, well-earned vacation. I'm here in his studio with Makani Christensen, who ran the Democratic primary against Senator Schatz, and John Carroll, who's the senatorial candidate for the Republican Party in the election coming up. Makani can't be with us for the rest of this show, and I wanted to get some more from him if we can. Makani, you didn't get three endorsements. Why not? I mean, you're a Naval Academy graduate. You're a good guy. You're a responsible local man. What's going on? Let's just
I believe there's a lot of politics that go into it. There's a lot of control factors on who people want to be the next senator, the next representative, and it's who you know, and if they feel you're ready. It was interesting not to get that support, but you know, regardless, you know, one of the things I learned from Ernie Martin, the city council, you know, I went into his office, I asked him opinion, him and Trevor Ozawa. I said, okay, guys, so, you know, me going around, going for endorsements, they were like, yeah, we all did that. And when we first ran, we got no endorsements. But, you know, it's getting out there, keep meeting people, and just perseverance. And not allowing people to change you by, you know, whether change your moral beliefs or the way you were brought up. And when I say that, you know, talked to Trevor last week, and you know, I let him know. I said, hey, listen, I know you're an outstanding individual. You're taking care of a lot of people in Hawaii, and especially your neighborhood. And the money issue came up with donors. And you know, I just mentioned, and he mentioned as well, we went back and forth, and, you know, one of his big things was, you know, Makani, if people want to give me money, they can give me money, but do not expect favors or special treatment, because, you know, you give me money, or you give us guys running money, it's not to, it's to put a candidate up there to help them out, to see that Hawaii's run better, right? And so, I mean, that was interesting, you know, learning that from him. And, you know, through my campaign, I didn't ask for money. A lot of people donated. You know, we raised $25,000 within a couple weeks.
All from small donations.
All from small donations, which was pretty cool. And, you know, there was businesses out there that did in-kind donations. Because they believed that the job at hand would be, I could do it. They believed in me after talking to them.
Did you find that there was any kind of fear factor that people were afraid to identify with what they felt would be not a winner, let's put it, you know, against a machine?
Absolutely.
They would be hurt in some fashion.
Yes. You know, you got a lot of individuals out there, which I talked to, that, you know, me running against Brian Schatz, they didn't want to help because they felt that if they did help in any way, Brian Schatz would retaliate and take it out on their business or in some way affect their bottom line.
You know,
which is illegal, but that's what was happening.
I wanted to ask a local kid like yourself ending up at the Naval Academy. Can you tell us a little bit about that path and how you found the educational system treated you in Hawaii and how it advantaged you in any ways and got you to where you ended up?
Yeah, so most of my childhood I went to public schools, you know, Pukalani Elementary, Then transferred to the Big Island Hilo, where, you know, Waikia Waena, Waikia High School, Waikia Intermediate, and then, you know, 10th grade, I had the opportunity to actually go to a private school, Kamehameha Schools. But, you know, the public schools, it was the teacher that made the difference. Those teachers that have influenced and shaped my life were those teachers that went above and beyond the call of duty, which most teachers in Hawaii do. And they are inspirations to me. You know, I still remember Miss Yamamoto and Miss Muranaka from Hilo. And this is elementary school. This is the fifth grade.
And what about them inspired you?
They actually gave me a chance. What they did is they gave me hope. What they did is they said, you know, Makane, you're better than what you're doing right now. You need to challenge yourself. And they did it in good words, like, you know. But more than that, they took the time and effort to actually take me in and teach me these things. And, you know, just the other day I was at Home Depot. I mean, not Home Depot, but Office Depot. And you see a teacher in there buying supplies for students. You know, a young teacher. And you look at that, and she's going above and beyond to make sure that her students are taken care of. And, you know, if our DOE right now, if our teachers feel neglected by the Department of Education, we have a problem. We need to make sure we take care of our teachers. And something needs to give. And I wouldn't be the best person to answer that question. I think the best people to answer the question and come up with a solution are the teachers.
This is just one point, this air conditioning issue, and, you know, the fact that it's been so darn hot in Hawaii over the last several years. Do you think, you're much closer to this than I am, Makani, because of your age. Do you think these kids can learn in an environment where it's so darn hot, the school is baking, they don't have an air-conditioned environment? Just right off the bat, what do you think about that?
At least they have a building. You know,
what do you mean?
You know, you can learn in the heat.
Okay.
It's not comfortable. We should try to make it better, especially last year was El Nino, so it was record hot. This year is going to be a little cooler. It's unfortunate that, you know, Governor Ige, I guess, promised $500,000 for ACs, and, you know, where's the ACs? Are they in yet? No. So let's make the classrooms where it's needed cooler. And unfortunately, you know, it's...
Well, you know, this is from a member of the public speaking here. Yeah. I look at some of the bids that they talk about for air conditioning the classrooms, and they look...
$20,000 for one AC.
They look ridiculous. What's going on?
I don't know. I guess I have no idea. What do you think is going on, John?
Well, number one is, I mean, I was a teacher. I have an extensive career as a classroom teacher, over 3.5 months. And I was making $435 a month, and the 35 was because of my military background. You know, they give you credit for 3 years of military. And anyway, I had an opportunity to fly at Hawaiian, and I was making actually more money flying part-time at the Air Guard than I was making full-time at a teacher. So as far as I'm concerned, and this is one of my major issues, and I really intend to address it in the U.S. Senate locally, and that is, number one, there should not be a federal Department of Education at all. We have provisions in this state for the so-called school community-based management councils, and if they had that and they had the money that's going to the DOE split up and distributed among the teachers and the administrations at the school level, you'd be able to have, nobody would even be thinking about where are we going to get air conditioning. They'd be in the schools already. And because the people here do want to take care of their own, and they would if they have the right leadership. But again, a lot of this stuff comes down to who's going to tell us what to do. So, I mean, that's, But anyway, as far as I'm concerned, there's a huge amount of things. What he's talking about, taking care of the teachers, is number one, and it is a local issue. But you've got the Common Core, which is a lot of baloney, and then you've got the DOE, which is totally ridiculous. We're number 50 of all the states in terms of educational achievement, and those are one of the reasons I'm backing up people like McConaughey here. Hope he'll be a Republican, but you know, that's the kind of leadership we need. But they've got a lot of really good Democrat leadership there, and I think that if you can focus their minds on what needs to get done and how they can do it, such as stream cleaning and cleaning a canal, there's a lot of things besides, you know, legislation that's
you're talking about community level involvement.
I'm sorry?
Community level involvement.
Exactly,
and
voluntary stuff where people go to the beaches and do these things because they've got a leader that's willing to take them, go there and do it with them. So that's a lot of what leadership's all about, and I just see that as having totally decayed. We had all go ahead.
Well, you know, I gotta run right now, but
so.
Just wanted to give a shout out to Cameron. Happy birthday, bud. That's my nephew. Turning 18
Happy
today.
Happy birthday, Cameron. Wow. McConaughey Christensen, thank you for joining us today, and I'm sure Carol Cox will have you back on a show many times, hopefully, to talk about these issues and your view of Hawaii as it's over the next
he'll be our next
years.
U.S. senator. So
that would be.
And guys, don't forget to call in. I'm leaving, but these guys can answer any question you guys have.
Thanks a lot, McCann. We really appreciate that.
Okay. All right, you guys. Aloha.
Okay. You call me tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, John, that was interesting to hear from a young, aspiring politician.
He's go ahead.
Hello?
Caller, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes,
go ahead, caller.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. I just had a couple of things I wanted to bring up. The first thing, I'm not sure who mentioned it, somebody said that the people on the Big Island and Kauai are paying for the rail.
We're having a small technical gap. Caller, are you still on?
Yes, he's on. I can hear he's talking.
Okay, great. I can hear you now. I'm sorry for a short burst. I couldn't. Can you tell us what's on your mind?
Okay. Yeah, I had a few things, but one of the things I heard mentioned a little earlier was that the people on the Big Island and Kauai are paying for the rail. I have never heard that before. I understood that people on Oahu are getting an extra charge put onto their excise tax bill, but I didn't know that the Big Island or Kauai were paying for it as well. Can somebody address that?
Yeah, I'm going to ask John Carroll. John, the caller's point is that he didn't know. So what's your response?
As far as I know, when money comes in through the excise tax, it goes to the general fund, and whatever gets taken out of the general fund to go to help pay the rail is basically exactly that. It's you're using the money coming in from statewide to take care of a project on Oahu. Now similarly, if they're going to put in a new road up on Mauna Loa or Mauna Kea or something like that, the people on Oahu are going to be paying for that as long as it's coming out of the general fund. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. But
no, that doesn't. My understanding is that there's an additional tax put on the excise fees that people on Oahu are paying an extra 0.5%, but the other islands are not paying that, and
okay.
That 0.5% is what's going to the rail.
I see. I'm not familiar with that, so.
Wow, really? Anyway, the other couple things that are really angering me and on my mind is the ridiculousness of rail being the wrong type of technology and an incredible amount of money being sucked out of our economy that could be used by the people for doing a lot of things. I just can't believe this is getting shoved down our throat. They're barely out of the pineapple field, and they're way over budget, running into the hole, and it's going to get a lot worse. They need to stop that thing now. And I'd like to find out who the hell are the, pardon the French, who are the people that backed this rail? Who are the ones that helped shove this through so we can say thank you when it comes time to vote? The second thing I'm very angry about is this ridiculous registration fee for our cars and stuff that's getting shoved down our throat. Both of these things are very, very harmful to the regular working people, to the middle class. It's just bad, bad legislation, and I'd like to get, I'd like to have those people pointed out who are the ones that are behind this, that shoved it in through the legislation, put it into legislation. I guess those are at least a couple of my concerns.
I think they're not only yours, the latter one, but also many members of the public today. John, do you have any idea who the primary pushers for the rail project have been?
Yeah, well, it's been going on, been going on for.
And thank you, caller.
Yeah, very, very good points. The rail inception goes back to when Lingle was in, and I think Mufi Hanneman was also in the mayor's position at that time. And they started it off at that point with about a $2.5 billion. Nobody was paying too much attention to it. I happened to be involved with an anti-rail group. I was acting as their attorney for about 2 or 3 years, and we had press conferences and so forth because the idiocy of it was very clear even at that time. But since that time, you've got people like Caldwell and, Abercrombie, everybody that's been in office for the past numbers of years has been in favor of it, including most of the people in the county council. And so what I would probably do is be to vote everybody out that's in county government at this time. In other words, the county councils on Oahu, the mayor, et cetera. But it's a huge problem as to what to do with the thing that we've got out there now. It's ridiculous. We have this billion-dollar project going on overhead, and the streets are laden with steel plates and potholes and everything else. It's just absurd.
We have further calls on the rail. Caller, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Such a public service. I am apolitical. I'm not a Democrat, Republican, Independent, and or anything else. I am an issue person, as many issues as possible. When you talk about the general excise tax, this is what happened. Governor Lingle had approached by Mufi Hanneman, and he wanted 1% added to the 4%, which would be 5%. She said, no, I'll give you 0.05% specifically for the rail. However, the state wants 10% of the 0.05%. I'll repeat that. 0.05% added on to the 4%, making it 4.05%. But the state takes 10% of the 0.05%. And
where does the rest go?
Go ahead, please.
Where does the rest go?
Pardon me?
Where does the rest of the excise tax go if the state's taking
that,
it?
That goes probably into the general fund.
Okay.
But supposedly 0.05% can only be used for the rail. Now, that is supposedly what has happened. I cannot confirm that, but as far back as I can remember, this is what it was proposed. Whether the other state counties, Maui, Big Island, have to pay that also, I thought it was not true. But recently I've heard that it is true. So that has got to be discovered or understood.
What's true? You lost me a bit on that. You mean that they are paying, Kauai and the Big Island are paying?
Yeah. Does the other counties in Hawaiian state have to pay 0.05% more when they buy a commodity or make some kind of financial transaction on the other islands? Are they also paying for the Oahu rail project for HART, Hawaii Authority Rapid Transit?
Yeah, we have to go. I'm sorry, Colin. This is John Carroll. You're bringing up a subject matter that neither one of us know that much about, but if you can leave a number for us, I will go research it and call you back.
I can tell you this, Mr. Carroll. I probably am the one that gave you your first $20.
Well, nobody
he still has it.
No, nobody else has given me another 20, so, you know. But yeah, thank you very much.
The issue that you bring up in terms of the Jones Act and rail, we simply aren't being educated. I'm not going to continue, but I would like to just mention the charter amendment, two of them, 4 and 12. I've taken notes, have their original documents, and it's got to be exposed to a public that on November the 8th is going to vote on two charter amendments, both with transportation, number 4 and number 12. And I thank both of you and everybody there, and Mr. Cox, of course, for everything that you do for all of us. And maybe the stadium, I'm not going to go into that. Just thank you very much.
On behalf of Carol, thank you for calling in and for sharing some of your knowledge with us. John, where we are now, if we're talking about rail, is that we have an election coming up, and one would have thought that on the other side of Mayor Caldwell's longstanding support of the rail, that somebody was going to jump into the race and actually express what I think is the public sentiment at this time, is that it is a rail to nowhere for nobody. And instead, Charles DeJoux has jumped in and apparently agrees that this is a rail that's going to go somewhere. Can you enlighten us on your thoughts about what you would do if you were the king right now with respect to where the rail is?
Well, the first thing I'd do would be to execute the people who put it in place. So,
all right.
I'm sorry you asked me that question, because I really do not know. My instinct, you know, as an American conservative, is that we ought to tear the whole thing down. But basically, the thing is too far gone for that. My sense was that they could stop it at the stadium, which is where they built it out to now, and then put, run buses out from there. The other thing is if they could make some other kind of use, make it some kind of a tourist attraction or something, or for running and biking and things of that sort. But the amount of money that would take to make access along the way is just prohibitive. So I just thank the good Lord I don't have the responsibility to take care of it. It's a terribly, terribly complex matter. There's a huge amount of money that's going to be spent one way or the other. Even tearing it down is horribly expensive. So I actually was at a dinner with Caldwell was at last night, and he was talking about being mayor, and I said, boy, I'm glad I don't have your job. He says, oh, I just love it. And I didn't want to say, well, I've never seen anything so screwed up as the way you've run this city, but that's...
Yeah, sometimes it's kind of almost ridiculous to say, but you almost yearn for the days of Frank Fozzie.
Amen.
Where somebody had an iron hand on the city and kind of... we have a call, and we're going to break for a minute for that. John, let's go.
Our previous caller has returned.
Hello?
Yes.
The responsibility goes back to Murphy, Hanneman, Lingle, Nestor Garcia, O'Keefe, and Wapo, all of the former city council members, with possible exception of two people. One was Barbara Marshall, and the other one is Ann Kobayashi. All of the different councils have collaborated to make this project possible. It could, in terms of the cost, the federal government gave Honolulu $1,555,000,000 for the project. This is going to cost, by their own admission, starting in the beginning, $3 billion, $5 billion, $7 billion, $8 billion, up to $10 billion. If we relinquish the $1.55 billion, we will save all the rest. This project has never been done right the first time. They did not accept the consequences of reality, whether it's underground utilities or transferring of land in terms of eminent domain, etc., etc. It is a travesty. It is corrupt. It should be investigated as fraud, and the whole thing should be stopped. It's better to stop it now and give up $1,555,000,000, sell what you can, derive as much as you can. But if you continue this project, who is going to pay for it? Public-private partnership in this kind of company? Would you invest $5 in this company? Look at their management. How many people from Hart were supposed to manage this? Kwan, Grabowskis, Bunda, and Hanabusa is leaving now. There is no CEO of any consequence to be held responsible for what's going on with the taxpayer money. Thank you both so very, very much. Good luck, and thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. I agree with you, by the way. So,
well, John, the problem I have just as a citizen in Hawaii is that I think that many, many people are opposed to the rail. I think that many people would not be opposed to just stopping it where it is, taking no more funding and ending it as the rail to nowhere for nobody, and cutting our losses. Now, I don't know, because nobody seems to ever, in the world we live in Hawaii, conduct any kind of referendum similar to the one where people didn't have information about it 4 or 5 years ago and voted out of a lack of knowledge and experience with it. But nobody seems to test the public waters to see how people feel, the people that are paying the increased taxes, the people that are going to be paying for this for the next 100 years. It just seems kind of, to me, a huge vacuum that nobody seems to care what it is the people think. In fact, we can't even speak for what the majority of people think, because nobody's doing any making any effort to ascertain that at this point. So we end up with two candidates, both of whom support the rail to nowhere for nobody. And I do think that there are many people whose jobs aren't dependent on it, and even some of those whose work is, who do not support it. But we'll never know that, because they're never going to ask, and the press is probably not going to ask either. So the press. So there we are, and we'll drop the rail for now. We're done with the rail, and I hope that it's not done with us, or it probably is not done with us. But let's go on to another subject. What area in your campaign do you feel most strongly about that you would try to accomplish as a U.S. senator?
Hey, well, number one is, we've already gone over, is the impact of the Jones Act on our economy, the strangulation that we're suffering. I believe that is something I can take care of in about 1 year. The other thing is very, very high on my priority list, and that is the national debt. I can remember in the days when we had, I don't know if we had surpluses, but we certainly didn't have any serious national debt at all, and now we're up to like close to $20 trillion. And this is absolutely absurd, and one of the main things I want to be looking at is where the government is spending their money, how it's being spent, and where it doesn't need to be spent, and getting that back in line. Plus, well, anyway, those, and then the other thing is, this is a little bit off course, but I ran for U.S. Congress in 1965. I was 66. And Nixon had run for governor and president and lost both races. I had lost the House race here, but I had been a hawk on the Vietnam War. Nixon comes into town. Nobody wanted anything to do with him, so I got to spend about 2 hours sitting in front of the terminal talking to him. So Vietnam War came up first, and, no, John, you're dead wrong. We shouldn't be there, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, when Eisenhower and I were in, the French asked us to give them logistical support. I mean, they asked us to put people into DNB and Pu to help the French troops, and we told them absolutely not. We'll give you some logistical support, but that's it. So that's an Asian boys' war. We shouldn't be there. And pretty much I think he was dead right on that one. The next thing was that he started talking about world peace and world trade and talking about opening up China and opening up Russia through free trade agreements. And what's happened now is I've listened to Trump, whom I thought was a total idiot when he first heard that he was going to run. And the more I hear him talk during those the presidential debates for the Republican Party, the more I began to think I was hearing Nixon, because he's really dead right on the issues of international free trade. So what I'm looking at is with our international debt that it's our national debt that we have, and looking at free trade agreements, it seems to me that that is where all of this can really be put in place, where debt can be paid off, where we can have essentially a world peace through that particular aspect. Now, that may sound like a dreamer, but I really think that can be.
Well, I hate to say, from my point of view, speaking again simply as a member of the public, 2012 elections put into office a lot of congressmen and senators that were given a mission, basically, to put a cap on the government spending and to use the power of the purse, which Congress has, to cut off funds when they were for areas where there was just a, you know, in the opinion of some, not all, there's certainly a strong segment of the United States population that supports deficit spending and supports massive government involvement. But the Republicans were given a mission to stop it, and they did nothing. They've done nothing.
Exactly, yeah.
How do you think, you know, do you really feel in your bones, John, that you're a Republican, or are you something else? Because I think the Republicans have disappointed, you know, everyone.
Well, they disappointed Republicans with what they've done. The debacle that we've seen in the House and Senate right now is really absurd. I mean, because they had all the good intentions of the Tea Party, and all of that has simply gone down the chute. Now, with Rand Paul in the House, and if we have a decent Republican majority, I think you're going to see major changes, and that what has been promised will be promised. As far as Hawaii is concerned, I guarantee you where I'm coming from. And your question is excellent, because, this is not on the subject today, but back in 1972, I offered a decriminalization of marijuana so that if somebody got caught with it, there was no fine or criminalization. So, and then Claire Booth Luce asked me to run for state senate as a libertarian. And I asked her why. She says, well, you know, what you believe sounds exactly like what we believe. Well, I didn't ever think I could get, but I really, I think of myself as a Republican, but in terms of what I think is right, I think for the most part, the Libertarian Party is more right on than anybody else. So
I guess I was trying to scratch that surface, because without taking a point of view as to whether deficit spending and massive federal government involvement in lives is good or bad, that's a point of opinion. What purpose does the Republican Party serve as an opponent to that point of view that government involvement is good, when I think that basically the bread is being buttered on both sides for the Republicans and the Democrats, and there almost ain't a difference in terms of real effect anymore?
Well, Linda Lingle is a perfect example of that. So, I mean, if you want to talk about Republican-Democrat, she got elected as a Republican, and she ended up taking she took out of the Republican Party platform the elimination of the Jones Act on the state of Hawaii. That's the kind of...
So what is the state of the Republican Party in Hawaii today?
Well, I think Fritz Rolfing's doing the best that he can. He's got a lot of problems in terms of the amount of money that they have, in terms of what they really stand for. They've been the state house members, like Beth Fukumoto, seemed like a very bright young lady, but she's just going along with everything the Democrats asked for, including allowing driver's license for illegal immigrants and stuff like this. I mean, just kind of crazy. And I just feel that we need something like a two-party system, which we really don't have right now. And I think it's going to have to come from leadership, where you want to call it conservative versus liberal, is rather than Republican versus Democrat.
Having lived here, John, you've been here since the mid-1940s. That's when you came over
in the late 40s.
Excuse me, John. I just don't. It's treading on toes.
1949.
You came over in the late 40s, redshirted, and played for the UH football team. Is that
that's
correct?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty cool. This homelessness problem that is so apparent over the last 5 years or so, have you ever seen anything like that in Hawaii previously at any point in time?
Never, yeah.
And to what do you attribute this? And if you have any suggested solutions for it, we'd love to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. That is actually one of my major issues is the homelessness. And if you, it almost makes me cry to think about these little kids living in tents. I'm sorry. But anyway, it's got to be addressed. And what it is number one, they're talking about how to house them or care for them and so forth. Nobody's talking about the root cause of why we have the homeless. It ties directly to the Jones Act and to this totally screwed up economy that we have, which is, you know, basically limited to whatever Alexander Baldwin and Mattson want it to be. And right now, the basic thing we can do for the homeless is to open up free trade to Hawaii, have a full economy here so that we can be, in a sense, like Singapore, where you've got enough tax money coming in to put these folks into decent low-income housing and have jobs available for those who can work and have enough money to take care of those who are unable to work. But beyond that, the whole economy will change, and I think fairly radically, if we can eliminate the shipping restrictions, because this place is just vibrant with opportunity for people who want to do things. We're the worst, and by every calculation I've seen, the worst state in the union in which to do business, the most costly state in the union to do business and to live, and with the worst education system. So we couldn't get any worse than number 50, and that's got to change. And I think in the U.S. Senate, I will make those changes fast.
One of the questions I have is, who are the homeless? I mean, and I know that sounds kind of stupid. Who are the homeless? Who are the homeless composed of? How many are people who have had a bad event, such as a medical emergency that required personal funds that depleted them of assets? And I'll give you a story, and it involves Carol Cox that I'd like to share with you and the audience in a minute. But we don't get any studies of what the demographics are. How many children, percentage-wise, are in the homeless?
Yeah.
All this other stuff goes on, but yet we don't even have a definition of what the specific problem is. Rents in Hawaii are at all-time highs. People, you can have a job, you can have two or three jobs, and simply not be able to afford the rent and paying for children. But nobody ever has taken the time that I've seen, maybe I'm wrong, to tell us who the homeless are, so that we can address the issues that involve the homeless and help. But here's my story. Carol and I somehow ended up in Kaka'ako at the homeless encampment about a year and a half ago.
Really? Yeah.
At about 10 or 11 at night. And Carol's got a lot of high-tech equipment, and we were filming some things at night. And he can see with his camera, he has range of several hundred feet.
Wow.
As we walked, two young boys, local kids, came up and they basically said to us, "Why are you here? What are you doing?" And I thought, oh, and they started talking, and it was kind of one person said, "I'm here to help my grandma." I thought they were going to ask us for money, which they did not. We were the only adult males that weren't homeless in the area at the time. It was about 10 o'clock. And one young man said, "My grandma hurt herself and fell, and she's had shoulder surgery. I live up on Pacific Heights, and I'm not supposed to be here. If my father knew I was here, he'd give me a licking. But I'm here to help my grandma." And I thought, wow, that sounds great. I wonder if it's true. Well, we walked through the camp, and a Hali woman in her late 40s with a shoulder sling on started talking with us, and she told us her story. Her husband was a union member in Hawaii. They lived a very happy life, raised their family, had kids. he got ill or she got ill, and they exhausted savings, lost their home. He was a veteran, so he went into Tripler to get some procedure done. And basically, by that time, they were homeless and living in the encampments. And she's very articulate, this woman was, and had an attorney. She should have had me, but she had somebody else for her fall incident, and that was great. And basically, she said that her husband said, you know, it takes a long time to check in. Come back tomorrow and see me. And she left, and when she came back the next day, he had died. When she got back to her tent, her computer was stolen. Every personal item she had was stolen. And she said that she had never felt more vulnerable. So this was her story, and she was telling it in a very articulate way. She said, my boyfriend is a Hawaiian guy. He's really tough. He's 6'2". He's huge. And nobody messes with him. And I'm not with him so much to be a mate as I am to have protection and to be a friend, and he's a friend to me. And I thought, oh, well, that's a good... Carol and I looked at her, and we thanked her for what she told us. We walked away. And by the way, while we were there, that kid came up that had told us he was helping his grandma. That was his grandma. And he brought her a drink, a refreshment. So that actually was a real story. But this is the fun part. Carol and I walk about 50 yards away. We're standing under a street light. And out of the distance, we see this massive guy, and he's, like, huge. And he's going, you guys, don't move. And I go, oh, my God, Carol. And he comes running towards us. And he's running, and he looked like a tackle on the San Francisco Giants. This guy was enormous. No shirt on. You know, I'm going, Carol, we're in big trouble, man. I don't know. Like, are you ready for this? And we're laughing. He runs up to us, stops, and he goes, he doesn't look at me at all. He goes, you Carol Cox? Carol said, yes, I am. He says, oh, brother, I love your show. He says, and then he goes in and he does a whole dialogue of Carol investigating a guy stealing copper from a state facility where Carol has apparently photographed this from a closet.
Wow.
And he does the whole darn dialogue from, I mean, just perfect, with Carol playing Carol. So then you said, Carol, blah, blah, and he goes on. He says, Carol Cox, I love you, man. And that was her boyfriend. And, you know, you could get to the... That was our experience, but what I'm saying is, underneath it all, for all the talk, nobody ever says these are the people that comprise the homeless element. 10% are people who had normal jobs and ran out of money. 10% are people who have a physical disability. It's hard for them to work. So many people in Hawaii are on disability today that that's a whole other subject. But how can you solve a problem, they keep saying? How can you solve it when you don't define it?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I don't see where any reasonable effort has been made to define the problem so that we can figure out a solution. As a U.S. senator, would you be involved in that kind of decision-making?
Absolutely, yeah. I was going to mention to you, I didn't want to interrupt, but that's a really interesting story. But if we got the Hawaiian homeland squared away so that you have, I happen to know statistics like 18 or 20% of the homeless are native Hawaiians who would qualify for Hawaiian homes leases.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, well, anyway, that's, yeah.
Carol.
No, but I'm very, very totally into that, getting, because the homeless thing for me is the single biggest actual problem we've got to take care of. I don't want to talk about it. It makes me almost cry to. Anyway.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, that was an interesting story about the kid who lived in Pacific Heights visiting grandma, who's a homeless person in a campment in Kaka'ako.
Yes.
It doesn't sound right. You know, Pacific Heights is probably a high cost area of living, nice homes. How come grandma is living homeless when she could be living with her son up in Pacific Heights? Kind of strange story. That's my comment.
I appreciate the story is, by the way, absolutely 100% accurate. Carol will vouch for that. I thought the same thing, but there must be housing in the Pacific Heights area that's not as expensive as the top homes. He did say that, and there, in the homeless people, that woman was very embarrassed about her position and about her descent into homelessness, and we didn't question her about why her family wasn't involved with her, and we took it on its face that there was issues of being estranged from the family because of absolute shame of being in a homeless condition and making them socially or familially undesirable. But as to the veracity of the story, it's 100% accurate as to why this woman wasn't being supported by her family. That would have to be something that she would have to answer, and John may have a comment on that. Thank you, though, for your call-in.
Yeah, I just was going to... Well, you actually covered what I was going to say. I know Jan is a very truthful guy, and from hearing that story, I'm certain there's nothing that is incorrect from what he understands. The other thing, Pacific Heights, I don't think there are any modest homes in Pacific Heights, because even a cheap home up there is probably $1 million. But I think whatever caused the problem between them could have been the boyfriend, could have been anything, but he had no reason to go into that, and I don't think he had any right to go into it. But it's a very good question.
Well, again, part of the question is a broader-based sociologic type of question that goes to what happens when the federal government puts its hands on virtually every aspect of people's lives? Does it break down the ability of religious institutions and churches and family members to support each other? As I said, most personal injury attorneys, and I'm one, know that many of the people who contact us today regarding different accidents, whether it's motor vehicle or a trip or slip and fall that some firms, and I do some of those cases, many of them, unfortunately, are on long-term disability, Social Security, more than ever. Over a long career, I've seen the amount of people who are on government subsistence of one form or another be magnified. Does that kind of relieve families of what otherwise would be a family problem? I don't know. I'm not a sociologist. But I would say that the long arm of government has probably impeded the type of structure, except where there's a strong family tradition or something that overcomes the involvement. And I think that also goes into education with some of the federal educational programs and the almost impact it has on family involvement. In some instances, I think the federal government doesn't even want the family to be involved. But again, these aren't areas of my expertise. I'm just raising the question. I think the caller's question is legitimate if he meant why isn't the family helping their family member. And again, I have no answer to that. Okay. John?
Yeah, no, thank you. Is that the end of the call?
No, there's no call.
Yeah.
What other areas, John, do you want to focus on your campaign?
That's what I'm fidgeting in my seat for. One of the major issues that we don't even talk about, and that is the war on terrorism. And everybody thinks, well, it's not going to happen to me, but I've done a study, or I shouldn't say, but one of the people who helps me has done a study. It looks like there's several thousand terrorist attacks around the world since about 2002, let's say, or 2001, when the Trade Center, when they hit the building with the airplanes. And as I had the honor to go to Air Command and Staff College and Air War College, and we studied in the 60s and early 60s in particular, unconventional warfare. And we are losing the war, and it's going on, and nobody seems to even understand it. And number one is you first of all have to identify your enemy. We have not done that. We just know it happens. And number two is you've got to know where they are. We have no idea where they are. The number three is you've got to find out if they have a command and control that's in place and who's running it and how they connect and so on and so forth. And then you've got to find out what kind of logistical support they're getting, find out where it's coming from, and destroy that particular asset for that, for conducting that warfare. In terms of losses, they lose one or two or three almost at the most of any of their attacks, and we lose anywhere from two, three to, you know, to close to 100, I guess, or even more than 100 in some of these attacks. And people say, well, it's not these people, it's not those people. But nonetheless, that is going on. And I hope to be on that with the, what we call Armed Forces Committee, or the committee that handles military matters. And we have got to set up a way to infiltrate and find out where these people are coming from, who's controlling them. We know some things. For instance, I didn't know it till fairly recently, but they are giving a lot of people a lot of monetary support, you know, for food, for rent, for housing, for medical, and so forth. And those are the people that are doing these, you know, suicide bombings and so forth. And we've got to be able to find out who they are, where they are, and what. And of course, it's pretty obvious they want to take over the world. And that is something that's not being looked at seriously in my book, and is something that the Armed Forces Committee should be totally dedicated to finding out what's happening, and then to win that war. And it's got to be done, or we're going to end up, you know, with the kind of stuff that's been going on all around this, all around the world, actually.
So, are you talking about domestically, John, or internationally?
I'm talking internationally. I mean, for domestically, absolutely, but. It's a war that, in other words, I do not want to see any American troops going anywhere right now. This is not, you know, nobody's using bayonets and mortars and, you know, tanks. That's gone. Well, but this.
Let's take domestically for a second. You know, we have Donald Trump, the candidate, saying, I'm going to build a wall, and it's going to be a great wall, and it's going to be a big wall, and it's going to be a fantastic, you know, whatever. I mean, it almost sounds ridiculous. Even though I think the concept may be worthy, the way that it's expressed kind of comes across like a cartoon. But in any event, what are your feelings about domestic terrorism? And do you label it? Because I have issues with that as well. I mean, if it were Christians that were a radical sect of Christianity that believed that they were going to liberate people to heaven by killing them, you know, would we call them radical Christians? So I have issues with it, even that are maybe, or would you say they were something else? So I, President Obama opposes, the Democrats oppose, many of the liberals calling this radical Islamic terrorism. Perhaps they have some basis for that. Perhaps they don't. What are your own thoughts about what we do, and how the heck does it impact Hawaii in any event?
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true. You got radical Islam, you got Hezbollah, and you know, et cetera, ISIS, and we don't know who they are, we don't know where they are, and I think, and who are just some nut that, you know, that's gone cuckoo and gone and done one of these things. You can't, you know, like, for instance, that one, I guess he was a black guy that was a veteran, and he shot six police officers, I forget where, and it turns out that he, you know, was a trained military guy, and everybody's, oh, this is just a guy that's gone nutty. Then they started looking at his emails and so forth, and they found a whole lot of this radical Islam kind of
materialized. Do you support the concept of the wall?
No, the concept of the wall, I think, is ridiculous. I really do. I mean, I'm going to vote for Trump, but I would vote against spending 10 cents on a wall. They got to, I mean, they want
even a pretty wall, the best wall.
the best wall they can have are 50 caliber machine guns and shoot anybody who comes across the border without. Well, anyway, I'm just joking, but I'm not really joking. I think the Border Patrol should be the wall, and they can see where these people. I've seen movies of, I mean, you know, film of people coming across, and they're just coming in willy-nilly. And
what would be your support or non-support for changing the immigration laws and restricting immigration again? The candidate Donald Trump has talked about looking closely at those nations where most of the terrorists come from, and putting a halt, at least for now, to those. Do you support that? Or
I wouldn't put a stop to it, but I certainly believe in extreme vetting of immigrants coming in now, no matter where they're coming from. Given that, I mean, that would be part of the strategy, and I think to do anything less would be constitutionally violative anyway. So,
do you see any of this terrorism as impacting at all on Hawaii or having the potential to impact Hawaii? Any of the terrorism, does it have any effect on this 50th island state?
It could very well. I mean, somebody could go to Arizona Memorial and blow that up, and it'd be a worldwide victory for them. And
I want to give as we end, John, thank you very much. John Carroll, U.S. Senate candidate for Republican Party, being here today with us. I also want to wish my girlfriend, Pat, a very happy birthday.
Okay, and listen, I want to thank you and Carol Cox and our gentleman friend here who's taking care of everything. My honor to be here. Thank you.
Again, appreciate it, John.